Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Shuttle Pod at the Disco. This is our fifth Discovery-themed episode in which we will discuss the sixth episode of Star Trek Discovery, which aired last night, Sunday, October 22nd. Today is Monday, October 23rd. I am Kaylee Iacovino, and I am joined today by Jared Whitley.
Hello, friends. Sorry I missed last week.
Hey, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
And you'll have to make up for the lack of Brian and Matt today.
I'll do my best. But I'm a little distracted, Kayla, because I'm trying to get a head start on my Christmas shopping. And I've been looking at some amazing stuff to buy at a website called Buy Buy Robot. Are you familiar with these guys?
Well, you know what? I am familiar with them. And all of our listeners should be, too, because the Shuttle Pod podcast is actually brought to you by the humans at Buy Buy Robot, purveyors of fine art from the future. Bye Bye Robot sells officially licensed Star Trek art made by multiple artists in many different styles at prices starting around $25. Go to byebyerobot.com to learn more.
That is a great idea. We should all rush to do that after we finish talking about the fifth episode of the Star Trek Discovery.
But before we get to that, it's prudent that we mention that today, just hours ago, it was announced that Discovery was renewed for a second season on CBS All Access.
Well done. Well done, friends.
So pretty exciting news. I think it's not terribly unexpected, sort of regardless of the quality of these first few episodes. Mm-hmm. Just given the, I mean, unless it totally crashed and burned, I've been kind of guessing it's going to get at least two, maybe three seasons. Just
sure.
Given how much money and attention CBS has given to the show.
As well as opportunity for, I mean, we just talked about our host at Bye Bye Robot, but as well as the opportunity for monetization, I mean, I expect to see a lot of people wearing those black disco shirts in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So that is some really smart product placement.
And just real quickly, since you brought it up, I just feel like I have to mention an article that we just posted a couple of days ago on TrekMovie.com. kind of highlighting some of the products that are featured in Discovery that you can actually buy that aren't product placement, but they say they used a shoe here, or the toothbrushes that you see in last week's episode with Stamets and Colbert brushing their teeth with those futuristic toothbrushes.
Great.
Like, that's a real toothbrush that you can actually buy.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And so we have links to it on our site and some other cool stuff that you can see in Discovery, including those T-shirts, which are super cool. And now they are canon.
Perfect. Perfect. There are some other interesting developments to canon that came with the recent round of Discovery episodes that we are going to dive into deeply today. So, Kayla, why don't you tell me a little bit about episode 5?
All right. So, episode 6 of Star Trek Discovery was called Lethe, written by Ted Sullivan and Joe Manosky. Joe Manosky is notable for having written Darmok, the Next Generation episode, among many others. And this one was directed by Doug Arniokowski. Mm. Nice Polish name, I guess.
Looks like it.
And so this episode was chock full of character development. It was chock full of canon in terms of adding new, very important things to the canon, and also maybe irking some people with some of the playing fast and loose with established canon that we're going to talk about.
Sure.
I thought we could sort of go by just seeing as how much character development was in this episode. I thought it would make sense for us to go through sort of character by character,
yeah,
and talk about, you know, what we learn about them, what their arc was, what their journey was, and all that cool stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Before we do that, I just want to touch on, I think I've said this every time, I think each episode of Discovery is just beautiful to watch. They have the right amount. The sets are terrific, right? They kind of look like Enterprise, and they kind of look a little bit like New Trek, but not so much that they aren't their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they still look like they fit within Star Trek. I love the uniforms. I think they look great. They look fun. They have the right amount of special effects in every episode, where it's never like the Star Wars prequels where they're just throwing stuff in your face.
It's a good point.
It's just the cinematography is so thoughtful and careful. It's not like typical hourly TV shows where they just have to shoot stuff for efficiency because there's so much to do and so little time. So yeah. I just love looking at these episodes, which, you know, we can talk about whatever points of canon or plot or character that we may like or not like. But every episode, I'm just delighted to be able to have this on my screen.
Oh, that's awesome. That's such a lovely thing to say.
Don't you think, though? I mean, isn't it great?
I totally agree. My personal favorite is whenever you see shots of Discovery in space.
Yep.
Obviously, it's in space, but you know what I mean? With some beautiful galactic backdrop behind it, and it's just lit so well.
Yeah.
And Matt pointed out on the last episode that really awesome shot of the camera that sort of follows the rings as they turn.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just beautiful stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, and they're taking advantage. I mean, like with TNG, with the way they shot it, they were pretty stuck at filming it at a flat horizontal angle, right? There are very few shots of the Enterprise that aren't from the same perspective, right? Hmm. But with this, because it's all CGI instead of a model, they can be a lot more creative in how they show the ship. And maybe they could have with the NX-01 in Enterprise 2, but they didn't because they were just so in the mode of this is how we film these Star Trek episodes.
Right.
And so the smart, creative, talented people have the freedom to show how creative and talented they are, and they're doing a great job every week.
I think there's plus and minuses that go along with so-called losing the corporate memory of how to make Star Trek, because it's been such a long time since Trek has been made. This is a whole different group of people. This is CBS doing this now.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't that, like, when Enterprise was on the air, that was at the end of that, like you said, this is how we shoot Star Trek. This is what it looks like. These are how the scenes are. And I'm not saying that they were totally boxed into that, but they're just, I think there naturally is some element of that. And so it is nice to see different things done in Discovery, even when they don't work.
Sure.
You know, maybe they fall flat for me and they work for someone else or vice versa, but it's still kind of nice to see something different. Like when you mentioned...
Absolutely.
Camera shots. I remember watching last night, there was this really interesting camera shot of Lorca and Tyler sitting in a corridor after they do their little training scene. And the camera is at a really low angle looking up at them. And and then the camera sweeps around them entirely.
Mm.
And it's a really interesting shot. I actually didn't really like it that much. I thought it was like a little bit too steep of an angle. I would have shot it a little bit higher up, but that's just like, you know, nitpicking. But in any event, I thought it was really cool that it was different. And there, like, I've not seen a shot like that so casually used in any other Trek. So it's cool.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. I remember, you know, so much of the way they shoot these guys walking through corridors historically has just been the cameras right in front of them as they walk. Right. I remember when we did
walk and talk.
Exactly, yeah. When we did The Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before, and I was doing the rewatch for that, there's one shot in Where No Man Has Gone Before where the camera is like up, pointed down, like while Kirk is waiting for an elevator or something. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's a creative camera angle. but that's about it, you know. And so to have some variety there is great.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't mean to beat that to death, but let's...
Not at all. We digress.
Let's continue on. We do.
In the interest of time, real quick though, before we dive in, just brief reaction. What did you think of the episode overall?
I think the Vulcan aspect of Burnham's character is a little weird to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so an episode that deals explicitly with it, I wasn't sure exactly what to make of it, to be perfectly honest. I don't think like the stiffness of the Vulcan-ness is playing to her strengths as an actress. I was watching some other YouTube videos of her, and she's so delightful and charming, right?
Mm-hmm.
That to not let her be charming is like going to the Kentucky Derby and leaving your best horse at home, or whatever it is that Bones says in 2009.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of my reaction. And then, you know, you can get into some of like the weird canon stuff with, not only did Spock have one long lost sibling, but now he's got two.
Yeah.
And anyway, so that's, I'm still thinking about it, at least the Burnham stuff. The other stuff, except for not having much Saru, I really liked, but just the Burnham stuff is still so weird to me. And what did you think, Kayla?
I really liked this episode. I think it was one of the strongest, if not the best episode for me so far. Definitely on par with, I thought, with last week's episode. One thing I really liked about it was the fact that it felt like the most standalone episode
in the absolutely.
Series so far.
Yeah.
It was bookended nicely with the scenes between Tilly and Burnham on the jogging track that summed up the whole, and just that final jogging scene summed up the arc that both Burnham and Tilly had taken throughout the course of the episode. And both characters grew tremendously, and they did it with each other, and both of them mentored each other throughout the episode. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought it was really, really nicely rounded out. And it's not, I felt like you could pluck this episode out without having seen the others, and still there's an enjoyable story that was told.
Yeah, and I wish they'd cut the episode out a little bit sooner than they did, because they threw some arc stuff with the Klingons on at the end that distracted from the nice bookending that you're describing.
Sure. All right, so let's dive right into this. Enough of this prelude stuff. Let's get right into the good stuff. So Burnham's arc, I just sort of alluded to that. She grew a lot in this episode, in my opinion. And again, it was the back and forth between her and Tilly, and she had help from other people along the way, including Lorca and Tyler. What do you think was Burnham's journey through this story for you?
Well, she's carried this guilt and sense of having failed her mentor, right? From not having gone down the Vulcan path and going to Starfleet instead. And here she wants to prove herself to Sarek. She doesn't just want to save his life, but she wants to say, I'm good enough to him, right? And then she realizes through the course of the mind meld that she didn't fail him. He chose Spock instead of her, right? And it's her kind of realizing that and then becoming okay with it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It was, for me, it was her healing old wounds. It was showing us the old wounds that she was still carrying. And for me, it was a lot about, too, her transition from being, you know, quote unquote, Sarek's ward, as he introduces her. He introduces her as his ward at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
She's transitioning from that, I feel, into her own person. She's no longer just his ward. She's her own individual person. And her journey in this reminded me a lot of my journey during my PhD, when I was getting my PhD.
Great.
And, feeling like I have this father figure who's my PhD supervisor, who is this father whose respect I'm always trying to attain. And, you know, sometimes I feel like I've let him down or he's let me down or whatever. And then sort of watching Burnham come to terms with the fact, after she goes to Sarek and speaks with him in the hospital bed, in the sick bay bed, and then goes and talks with Tyler and is basically saying, I have all these emotions. And she kind of just comes to terms with the fact that Sarek, she's removed him from this pedestal, I feel like, that she's put him on.
Yeah.
And she's like, he's flawed, you know, and that's okay. And he's made mistakes in the past, and that's hard, but that's what it is. And it's not my fault for having failed him. You know, I felt like that was it was like a relief for her to come to terms with that. And I've definitely have gone through similar things like that myself.
Oh, wow. Well, that's nice.
And I think also there was a big theme with Burnham in terms of her mentors, which you could include Tilly among those, but also specifically in terms of father figure mentors, because we have Sarek, who's the old mentor. And then at the end of the episode, Lorca is like her new father figure. You know, throughout the episode, he showed more compassion than we've seen him give towards anything so far. You know, he immediately agreed to help her find Sarek. He was encouraging and supportive of her, and then he offered her a permanent position on the Discovery. And so I felt like she was transitioning into this new stage of her life where she has this new mentor father figure, which is Captain Lorca.
Sure, because he's adopted her.
Yeah, exactly, which I think Tilly even says that at one point.
Yeah, and we have to say we don't know how altruistic Lorca is compared to Sarek, right?
Yeah. Well, in fact, this is maybe a good time to transition into talking about Lorca, because we learn an awful lot about him in this episode.
Yeah, we do. We do. He's an interesting character. Tell us more, Kayla. What did we learn about Lorca this episode?
Well,
besides the fact that he does okay where the ladies are concerned.
Right. he has some things come up from his past, including some old flames. Well, one old flame, I suppose. But, you know, so far I feel like we've only seen this battle-hardened warmonger Lorca.
Yeah.
You know, he's very cutthroat, to the point, does what needs to be done. So we see some of his past coming up to greet him again, in the form of Katrina Cornwell, the admiral, who he's had some love interest with in the past.
Yeah.
But also sort of, I feel like that also brings forth a different side to him that we hadn't seen. So he's much more caring. He's much more compassionate. We also see maybe the reason that he's changed is that war has changed him. You know, he's a man in crisis. Yeah. He needs mental help. You know, he's mentally ill right now. Basically, he's dealing with probably PTSD.
And tremendous guilt.
And tremendous guilt from whatever
survivor's guilt, I guess it's called.
Right. And we don't know the full story of what exactly happened, but clearly it's affected him to the point where he's brandishing a phaser on his girlfriend in bed when she touches him.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the ladies don't like it when you do that, in my experience. They prefer you to leave it out of arm's length.
So, I don't know. What did you... I feel like we got to know a different Lorca this episode. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, especially with the stuff that we learned from him last week. He continues to have some different layers. And I saw this video with a theory about Lorca, which I don't know if you're familiar with this. I think I sent it to you, but there's so much material on Star Trek nowadays, it's hard for us to keep up with it, which is great. It's a great problem to have. But the theory I saw advanced is that Lorca is part of Section 31, that he's it's a Section 31 ship, and that a lot of the way that they draw new recruits is not necessarily by handing them a pamphlet and saying join Section 31 to protect the Federation, but coercing, tricking, or even just lying to people to convince them to become members of the organization to do whatever shady stuff they do. And the theory, and I wish I'd been smart enough to think about this, the theory that I'd seen advanced to support this is the fact that Discovery's numerical designation is 1031.
Yeah. In fact, there's some of that we talk about in the article that we did on that fan theory. But the 1031 thing, it's the story since before Discovery aired was that 1031 came from Brian Fuller's love of Halloween.
Yeah, I think that may have been
1031 is the date of Halloween.
Yeah, that may have been a misdirect.
Well, I mean, you can you know, I invite listeners to go read the article that we have the Section 31 theory. It seems like one of the less viable fan theories in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But there's a lot of them out there, and that's only fun for us to go through.
Yeah. Yeah. And anyway, it was just something interesting. And his eagerness to have this recruit who has no other who's very capable, but who's stuck and have no other choices, right? No other where to turn. That seems like a good recruit for a shady organization like this. Anyway.
Well, definitely. I mean, Lorca has been given... As he said, he's been given tremendous latitude to do his job the way he thinks he needs to do his job.
Has his personal fiefdom.
Yeah, and I think there's even a line in this week's episode where Cornwell says, you know, don't let this become your personal fiefdom.
Exactly. Yeah, that's not Cornwell.
Yeah, which is great because you can clearly see that's what he wants it to be. He wants all the control and he wants to do what he thinks is best. But, I mean... Here's the other thing, too, though. If I feel like this sort of blows the Section 31 thing out of the water.
Let's hear it.
He has to talk to Starfleet at all. They know what he's up to. He has to call Starfleet to say, I'm going after Sarek. You know, even though he decides to do it himself, but then he gets in trouble for that. You know, he gets chastised. And Section 31 is supposed to be this clandestine organization that Starfleet isn't even really, officially, they don't even exist.
Sure.
So, you know, if he were a Section 31 ship, I feel like he wouldn't be communicating with Starfleet at all.
Yeah, especially once he has a magic device that lets him go anywhere he wants.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He would just be like, all right, I'm going to go do my thing because I have zero oversight.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting – it was a fun theory. The one thing is – I mean, we saw – they introduced Section 31 in Deep Space Nine. They brought it back in Enterprise. They brought it back again in Into Darkness. I don't want to see them bring it back yet again. That's the main reason why I hope it's not true. I will say, though, Captain Lorca did quote Captain Sisko in this episode. There's an episode of Deep Space Nine called Fortune Favors the Bold, and Sisko name drops it at the end of the episode. And that's how Lorca goes out on this episode, as he says, fortune favors the bold. So I don't know if that's a little wink to Deep Space Nine. It also might be a common enough of a phrase that whoever right. wrote it didn't even realize that. But,
right.
Of course, that's the kind of thing people like me need to talk about.
That's so cool, though. I totally did not get that at all. I would love if whoever wrote that line was alluding to the actual episode. Like you said, it could just be they happen to use that phrase. But how cool if that was actually a little in joke.
Yeah, the one line I hope they quote eventually is there's an episode where Riker says, "Fate protects fools, little children, and ships called Enterprise." I want to hear someone else say that.
And ships named Discovery.
Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, anything else about Lorca, or do we want to move on?
I think we can move on.
Okay, let's do it. Do we want to talk about Tyler?
Yeah. So, yeah, speaking of Lorca, he is tied up quite a bit with the newest member of the Discovery crew. I guess, unless you count Michael, Ash Tyler, who we met in the previous episode when Tyler and Lorca were imprisoned together on a Klingon ship. And we get to meet Tyler this episode, the guy who's supposed to be, you know, just broken out of prison for 7 months and yet seems, you know, pretty okay.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly okay.
He's got his mental state well enough together that he understands that he can lie to his boss to improve his station.
Yeah, that was interesting. And you knew that was coming, right? As soon as he said, "Oh, it looks like I'm the one who needs to do more target practice," you were like, he just lied about his score and he beat him.
Yeah, and he didn't just lie a little bit. Like, he got 50% more kills than Lorca did, I think. I think he got...
Yeah.
Lorca got 24, and Tyler got 36.
It's kind of amazing to think that Tyler wouldn't stop and think that Lorca wouldn't notice, because that was right after, at the end of a discussion they were having where Lorca picked up on these little tiny inconsistencies when Tyler said, "Oh, I'm from Seattle," and he's like, "Oh, actually, you're from like this little town just outside of Seattle, aren't you? So you're not really from Seattle." You know, he's picking up on these little tiny details, and then Tyler tries to pull this one on him.
Yeah.
It's like Lorca doesn't miss anything. He sees everything that's going on around him.
Yeah. I didn't think about it from that, but that's clever.
But you know, I felt like the writers really want us to like Tyler.
And, yeah, they
I
do.
Mean, I don't mean that necessarily in a way that it was a stretch. I really like him. I'm still very, very suspicious of him.
Yeah.
Because of the way in which we encountered him, you know, in this Klingon prison and his story not adding up. By the way, just side note, we don't have to go into this today, but speaking of fan theories, if you're not aware of the fan theory related to Tyler and what his deal is, definitely check out that article on Trek Movie. We just do a complete, very, very thorough, maybe too thorough analysis of the fan theory and say whether it could be right or not. So,
do you have any details about that you want to share to sort of tickle people to go check it out?
I guess I'm a bit afraid to spoil anything. So we're sort of treating some of the fan theories that seem plausible. We're just telling people, you know, sort of treat them as spoilers in case any of it turns out to be true.
But
I guess what I will say related to Tyler is sort of like, who is this guy? And not only do we break down in-universe evidence to support the fan theory, but there's also a lot of real world evidence to support the fan theory.
Real world evidence.
Yeah. So I won't go into, like I said, I won't go into too much detail. Do check out that article though if you want to learn more.
Okay.
So,
Are there any other details from that exchange with Lorca that we need to drill into a little bit deeper?
All right. So the setting in which we meet Tyler again is really important, I think, for us to talk about. And this is a really big, this is maybe the biggest fan uproar of the week, which is the holodeck that's not a holodeck.
Mm.
What did you think when you saw this scene?
It didn't particularly bother me, to be perfectly honest, because the thing about the holodeck that makes it so magical is the artificial intelligence, but it didn't really get to that level until the Binars did their reprogram in 11001001. Yes, I do know the name of that episode. There's also like the replicator, which we don't quite have replicators, and also like the force fields that keep moving, so you can be in a holodeck for an hour and you can keep moving and like walk through the streets of London playing Sherlock Holmes, but you'll stay within this confined space, and the magic of the force field projection will be able to trick you immersively completely. Whereas here we just have projections for target practice, basically.
Right.
And the fact that it's portrayed as so primitive and so plausible, given the level of technology that they have and, frankly, that you and I have access to right now, it didn't seem weird to me at all. It seemed perfectly normal.
Nice. You know, I have to admit, when I saw it, I thought to myself, that looks an awful lot like a holodeck, which we know doesn't exist because the pilot episode of Next Generation, you know, Riker has this whole scene where he's going on and on about how amazing it is and how new the technology is. The best explanation that I've heard someone come up with for what this thing is, because at first people are saying, okay, well, if it's just holographic projections and nothing is solid, it's just like their communication technology when they go ship to ship.
Sure,
you see those holographic people.
Yeah.
But it did kind of look like they were touching walls and leaning on things. So a really good explanation I heard is like they have, imagine sort of a plywood, you know, set, basically, and then you project a holographic paint basically onto it to make it look like a Klingon ship, or make it look like a Romulan ship, or make it look like a Federation ship, or make it look like a hospital or whatever you want, and then have, so then you could lean on the wall, because it's a real wall, it just has a hologram projected onto the front of it, and then you can have holographic characters, which you know, your arm would go right through them.
Sure, because they would be holograms and not force fields with holograms around them.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's just a much simpler technology. So I could buy that. As you know, I think, I guess they could have made it a little more clear, you know, because it did look very much like a holodeck. And it wasn't 100% clear to me these specifics of the things that we're breaking down right now. You know, was it a wall reel, or was it a force field with photons, or was it, you know, so I don't know. I think they didn't need to make it look that fancy. I think they could have had... I think we maybe even see the walls fizzle out at some point, so implying that, you know, it was a holographic set that they were on. If they had just had the Klingon holograms fizzle away and everything else stayed there, and it's like this permanent target practice area, shooting range, you know, where they just added holographic people... I don't know. I guess that they could have gone a little bit, worked a little bit harder to make it more obvious that it wasn't a holodeck, just knowing that people would get outraged about it because
just made it virtual reality, right? Just
or say something. That
they have headsets on instead of projections.
I mean, the only thing that I'm okay with them bending the rules of canon, to be honest, because a lot of this series does visually for one thing. I think I don't mind it at all when it's in service of the story.
Sure.
And I just feel like this didn't necessarily serve the story. They could have changed it and the story would have been intact.
Yeah.
So I just wish they had.
Yeah. So my rule for that is always, if the problem could have been solved with one quick line of dialogue or something comparably small, then it is not a problem. For example, when Geordi and Scotty are on the ship in the Dyson sphere and they beam them out while the shields are still up, right? If Picard had simply said, time the transporter to beam them out the second that the torpedo hits the Janolan shields, right? Then everything would have worked perfectly. So I'm okay with it. If just that one little line that a transporter chief could have said off screen, then it's fine.
Sure. That makes sense. So it's consistent in universe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, that's the holodeck. That's not a holodeck. I felt like, you know, that we have to talk about that because
absolutely.
There are already there are already tirades about how everything is a disaster because there's a holodeck on the Discovery.
Yeah. The other thing, and I think I said this a couple weeks ago, we have to realize that in 1996, a genetic Superman did not start World War III in India, right?
Yeah.
That did not happen. So real life has already I'm sorry about this. I'm sorry, everyone. Real life has already contradicted Star Trek canon.
Also, our technology that we're using to record this podcast already far surpasses pretty much anything on the original Enterprise.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, like, there's a scene, an encounter at Farpoint that I just roll my eyes at it now, where Riker, you mentioned the holodeck, where Riker is trying to find Data, and he stops some junior officer and says, where do I find Lieutenant Commander Data?
Oh, yeah,
and
the lights.
She says, just follow this beeping light. And it's like, that looks so primitive, right? And he's just so dazzled at, oh, the amazing things this galaxy-class starship can do.
Right.
And it's like, now he wouldn't have to ask anyone. His onboard GPS or whatever would point him directly to where he needed to be and to be projected on his Google Glasses or whatever it is. And he'd be able to get there much more conveniently, and he wouldn't need some dorky glowing light to get him there. So
that looks like it should be on a cruise ship.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but the entire Enterprise D kind of looks like a cruise ship.
So yeah, it does.
Yeah. So we have to make some concessions, and this is one that I'm happy to make.
Speaking of canon, I think we should jump right to this point.
Yeah,
it's a big part of this episode, and it's where Discovery has added substantially to the canon.
Mm-hmm.
So in this episode, you know, we see Michael Burnham flashing back to a time on Vulcan.
Which again looked terrific. I love the scenes on Vulcan.
And I think they shot on location for that, which made it look awesome because so often we're used to
bottle
episodes.
Yeah, they went to a real place with real buildings. It was not in Toronto. It was not in front of a green screen with George Lucas drinking his coffee in a chair
with blue milk. So yeah, it was a really nice scene. I do have to admit the little thing where Burnham like throws her arms back and does this weird like there's like 10 of her flying off into space was a little bit trippy.
Okay,
I think they did a little bit too much LDS when they put that shot together. But it was cool.
Well said,
I liked
well
it.
Well said.
So this really important thing, right, happens on Vulcan when Michael does not get into the Vulcan Science Academy. And, of course, we learn that it's because Sarek was asked to make an impossible choice, which shouldn't have been so impossible for a Vulcan, according to the other Vulcan guy, which is basically choose between your children. Michael can go, because she's not really a Vulcan, she's human. And your other son, who's, I guess, a young child at this point, he must have been, 10 years old or something? Mm-hmm. He's a lot younger than Michael. So his young child, who's half Vulcan, so he's not really Vulcan either. God, Vulcans are racist.
Yeah, I don't like the making Vulcans arrogant, right?
Dude, it goes right along with Enterprise.
I know. Yeah, and then they did it in 2009 as well. My attitude my headcanon has always been, like, Vulcans are so capable, but humans are in charge of the Federation. Why is that? They are, to quote Star Trek VI, no, Star Trek IV, Vulcans are the intellectual puppets of the Federation, right? and my attitude has always been Vulcans are very capable, but they know that, like their Romulan cousins, they are very prone to arrogance, which can lead to xenophobia and can lead to all these problems. And so in their wisdom, they have decided, we shouldn't be in charge of this organization. We should let other people be in charge of this, right? We have to stay back or else we'll become Romulans. So
I like
it. Yeah, I like it too. It seems, pardon the expression, it seems logical, right, for them to behave that way when they have this very bad example that they don't want to emulate. And so every time we have to put up with them thinking they're better than everyone in the world, like, contradicts their behavior for everything that we'd seen, apart from, these few examples we've mentioned.
Yeah. And at the same time, though, it kind of makes their race a bit more three-dimensional. You know, you're going to have, because the Vulcans do have emotions, right? Just like you said, the Romulans are this expression of the more emotion-heavy stuff, and the Vulcans are the more logical side. But you're going to have a spectrum of people, so you're going to have some some racist assholes.
Sure.
the Vulcan community.
And apparently suicide bombers as well.
Right. And a almost religious zealot.
Yeah. So I'd say suicide bomber.
Logic is treated very much like a religion in Vulcan. You know,
sure. The Kolinar exercise is like any kind of religious ordination.
Yeah, and teachings of various Vulcans in the past that they follow and things like that. So yeah, we had a religious fanatic suicide bomber. That was a pretty blatant allegory. And then we have a bunch of racist assholes in the Vulcan Science Academy, apparently, who ask Sarek to choose which of his children will go to the Vulcan Science Academy.
Oh, I hated when the guy called them experiments.
Oh yeah, another one of your little experiments.
Oh my gosh, that's so awful to refer to a living being that way.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess in his eyes, what Sarek was doing was wrong, like by raising Michael as a human. But then again, I don't know what you could say about Spock. I guess that guy thinks that Spock should never have existed.
Sure. Well, that marrying Amanda was some experiment. Him playing the long game for this experiment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So of course, anyway, back to this really important piece of canon that we've been winding our way towards. Now we know, because we know that at this point, during the events of Discovery, Spock and Sarek are not speaking to one another. And that's because when Spock...
Oh, sure, from Journey to Babel.
So when Spock went through the training to join the Vulcan Science Academy and then said, no, I'm not going to join, I'm going to go off to Starfleet instead, it caused such a rift between him and Sarek that they didn't speak for like 18 years.
Yeah.
And now we know why. Now we know why Sarek was so upset. I mean, not that it's justified, but now we know why Sarek was so hurt and upset when Spock decided to join the Federation instead of the Academy. Or at least it just gives it another layer of us understanding that situation. Yeah. I thought that was really interesting.
Because he didn't just hurt Sarek by making that decision, he hurt Michael as well.
And Sarek probably felt a tremendous amount of guilt.
Sure, yeah.
Because he's like, look, I made this choice, and not only did I hurt Michael by making that choice, but it totally backfired. So now I don't have anyone in the Vulcan Science Academy.
So that kind of makes sense to do it that way.
I thought it was cool. The moment I realized, like, oh, that tells me more about Spock and Sarek's relationship. Watching this episode, Spock is mentioned by name and that's all, which was cool. Spock shout out. There's also an Enterprise shout out, which is nice.
Wait, what was the Enterprise shout out?
Burnham says to Tilly, then you should apply for a transfer to a Constitution class ship like the Enterprise.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you meant Enterprise, the TV show. Yeah, you're right.
No, sorry. Yeah. The ship. And there was a Spock shout out, but he was only mentioned in name. And yet I felt like this episode does a lot to add to his backstory, which is hard to do for such a well-established character.
Certainly. Yeah.
So I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It emotionally fit in with what we know about these emotionless characters.
Right. Emotionless in quotes.
Sure, in quotes. I'm making air quotes that nobody can see.
Oh, good, good.
Thank you. Okay. Oh, do we... Are they ever going to mention Cybok? Or is that haram?
I don't know. Oh, God. I think it'd be too much.
I don't think they're ever going to mention Cybok.
I don't think they need to. And if they did, I feel like it would be shoehorned in if they did.
Yeah. Nor will they ever mention the quote-unquote Vulcan princess that Sarek was married to. Right. What does that even mean, Vulcan princess?
Do they have kingdoms?
It seems illogical.
It does. Is there anything else about the Sarek Spock Michael trifecta that we want to mention?
Do we think they'll ever get anyone to appear as Spock?
Good question.
Do you think they would get Zachary Quinto to play Spock in an episode of Discovery?
I think he would cost way too much.
I don't think he would.
Yeah, right? I guess I'm saying the same thing as you. I think he would say, yeah, I'll do it for $1 billion. You know what I mean? Like, I think he'd price himself out of it.
I don't know if he would. I mean, he doesn't even have a box office. I mean, his career has, I mean, and of course his career is better than mine and ever will be. But his career has been unimpressive enough. He doesn't even have a dedicated boxofficemojo.com page the way most actors do.
But, right? You know, the way also the
Christopher Pine and Simon Pegg do.
But he's Kelvinverse Spock. You know, he's not prime Spock. So it would be weird. I would not like that if they did that. I think
you would not like that.
Necessary? No, I think they don't need to. I don't think we ever need to see Spock. The show isn't about Spock.
I agree that it's unnecessary.
Yeah.
I also kind of think all the Sarek stuff is unnecessary, though, to begin with.
I think it's better to do a Sarek story than it is to do a Spock story.
That I agree with.
I do see what you mean of they only chose Sarek. Like, why does everyone in the world have to be related to Spock?
Yeah, but, yeah. Why couldn't her mentor have been, you know, the Daystrom guy, right? Or
some random other Vulcan.
Or some random other Vulcan. Or how about T'Pau, right? The priestess from Amok Time.
That would have been awesome, actually.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Because we don't see that many female Vulcans.
Sure.
In general, in the series.
Well, yeah, except for T'Pol. I was thinking, yeah, you're right. I was thinking about, you know, maybe they could have made T'Pol her mentor and bring her back for Enterprise. But I think Jolene Blaylock has totally cut off ties with the franchise. I've never seen her at a convention.
So, all right, just to sort of bring us back.
Yes, please, bring us back.
Plot points. I feel like there's a few other things that I'm going to throw into our random bits section here at the close of the podcast that we should talk about. Firstly, I just want to briefly mention Stamets. We didn't see him that much in this episode, but he was acting very strange, and I thought it was very interesting that they mentioned that ever since he went through the spore drive, you know, ever since he injected himself with that stuff and went to travel through the mycelial network, he's acting all kind of happy and almost giddy in a really uncharacteristic way. Mm. So I think we're going to see a lot more from Stamets in terms of this progression. I think his trip through the mycelial network affected him a lot more strongly than we realized. Alluding, of course, back to the stare into the mirror.
Yeah,
at the end of
the
last episode.
Yeah, yeah. That was almost too much.
I know, but I still liked it.
So did I. He may as well be growing the goatee, right?
And stroking or you know, twirling the mustache part of the goatee.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I thought it was important to mention Stamets, even though we didn't see him that much. I think we're going to see more from him. Can we just talk about the synthesizer for a moment? Notice I didn't say replicator.
No, you didn't. Well said. Yeah,
Matt Wright, our other co-host, would have scolded me if I called it replicator because he's right. It's a synthesizer.
Yeah. It's giving a little bit more nutritional advice than we're used to seeing from these things.
to put it mildly, yeah. The thing is flat out annoying.
Yeah, my hunch is very much the way people have apps that can do that for their nutrition right now. Obviously, they could still do that in the future. My hunch is Michael has the settings turned up on this because she wants the replicator to be more talkative.
God, I hope so. Can you imagine Lorca at that thing? He's like, give me some nachos. And it'd be like, nachos are unhealthy. Why don't you try this wrap? And then he would just shoot it with a phaser.
Yeah, shut up. Give me a pig's heart. Still bleeding.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
God, I hope you can turn that thing off.
I'm sure you can. It kind of reminded me also of the elevator that annoys Scotty on the Excelsior, where it like says thank you to him and, you know, just try to be a little bit more artificially intelligent. And he says, up your shaft.
Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah.
It also reminds me of the Scotty in the TNG episode Relics, where he's going into the holodeck, and he's like,
drunk
at that point. He's like, hey, the android told me you could show me my ship. Let me see it.
And
the computer's like,
yeah.
What are you talking about? Mm-hmm. You know, it asks like for specifics, and it goes on and on and on. But yeah, synthesizer, not the replicator. Very overly talkative and annoying. And speaking of the synthesizer, I just have to do this because I'm me, and I wouldn't be me if I didn't bring this up. Antioxidants. The synthesizer. Darn it, Matt's in my head telling me to say synthesizer.
It's because he put his Katra in your mind when you were hurt.
Just like Sarek. Oh, exactly. God. He's controlling me right now. So the synthesizer tells Michael Burnham that her green tea is healthy for her because it's high in antioxidants. And I was very, very sad to hear that because antioxidants are a modern pseudoscience fad.
And have actually no
bearing in real science.
It's not real. Oh,
antioxidants are a thing, and they are in foods like green tea.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence to support that they have any health benefits.
Oh,
a lot of foods that are healthy for you, like vegetables and fruits, have antioxidants in them. But all studies show that it's probably has nothing to do with the antioxidants. It has to do with all the other healthy stuff that's in fruits and vegetables.
The minerals and everything.
Yeah. So I was really sad that they threw that in there.
Interesting.
It's a little nitpick for me. But I also have to say that science overall in this episode, didn't love it.
Oh, really? Like what other science stuff didn't you love?
Well, I thought a big part of the plot hung on this idea that, you know, Michael goes to Stamets and says, hey, I have this idea. Let's just make this mind meld device that I'll wear. And he's like, oh, that's genius. It'll just amplify your signal and you'll just like beam right into his brain. Like that made no sense to me. I was okay with it because I enjoyed the story a lot. And so I was like, I'll just go along with it because if you accept it, then the rest of the story is fine.
Yeah.
But the device that she puts in her head and the you know, what were they talking about? No one seems to even have known that he could beam his Katra in this way. And now all of a sudden they know the frequency that he's broadcasting on?
Yeah. A non-Vulcan develops this telepathic technology in the span of 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was kind of unbelievable for me.
Yeah. See, something I thought would have been cooler would have been if they found some other MacGuffin for that. Like, okay, it was established in the TNG episode Gambit that there are Vulcan telepathic artifacts, right, that can be used to amplify their abilities. Let's say that maybe Lorca has one of these in his trophy room, and they take that and they use that to help her sniff out Sarek. I thought that would have been better. If they're going to do something that's magic, just do something that's magic instead of you know, the pseudoscience stuff.
You know what? 2 points. First of all, I think you just came up with that right now, and that's freaking genius.
Thank you.
They should be paying you to be the canon expert on the show.
Oh, wow. I would take that job. I think I'd be pretty good at it.
Because that you just plucked that one right out of there. That was really impressive.
Thank you.
And number two, as much as I love that, I'm just imagining, because you know how I always like to think about the alternate universes that exist in which we have various other podcasts.
Oh, and so yes, of course.
I'm imagining the alternate universe in which we're doing this podcast, and that happened on the show. Uh-huh. They did that exact thing. And we would be complaining about how it felt like they just picked this random bit of canon and were trying to, like, call back, and it was just fan service.
And it was too forced. And that, with the Vulcan suicide bomber, it was too much.
It was too forced. God, think of an original idea.
Seriously. Come on, you guys in this other universe. I hope this thread is something you continue through the course of this podcast, Kayla.
I think it will be because I really enjoy it.
Have you been watching a lot of Rick and Morty? Is that why you're thinking about alternate universes a lot?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I have not, actually. My old roommate used to love that show, but I only ever caught it when he would have it on TV.
Interesting.
The last random bit, unless you have others to add, that I want to make sure we bring up.
The elders of Carcerai, these aliens that get killed at the end, are they from anything? I didn't recognize them from anything at all.
No, I assumed that they were brand new, but
I think they were brand new.
We should Google this too, because maybe they're a memory beta kind of thing.
Oh wow, that's deep stuff. Huh. I'm seeing something from the Realm of Adventure wiki. Oh, this is something from Dungeons & Dragons. Oh, yeah. I think it's a Carcerai is a Greek mythology thing So that's where that term sounds so familiar, and that's going along with the whole idea of the River Lethe thing.
Yeah, so awesome.
It's tied into that pre-existing, human lore, but it's not something from Star Trek.
How cool, though, that the writers, because, good writers always pull multiple threads through a narrative.
Yeah.
How cool that they've pulled this real world thread in such a subtle way. That's pretty artistic, actually, to have the Lethe and the Greek mythology worked into this episode. That's pretty cool.
That is clever. That's some deep stuff they're working on right there.
One more thing I think we have to talk about, and I'd love your opinion on this too, is Vulcan. I think it's one of the first shots of the episode, very beginning of the episode, where we meet our suicide bomber.
Yes.
And they take off in this very cool looking ship, and in the background we see a gigantic planetoid.
Oh, okay. All right.
Did you notice that?
No, I didn't.
So in one of the first things that at the very beginning of the episode, some of us were chatting in the Slack, and someone said, Vulcan has no moon.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I went, because I saw it and I thought, oh, maybe they're not on Vulcan, but the rocks look like it's supposed to be Vulcan. And it turns out it is supposed to be Vulcan and it's not a moon, but it is a co-orbiting planetoid called T'Kut.
Okay.
So it's sort of canon, sort of not. It was established and fleshed out in non-canon things like novels, but it was also in the encyclopedia.
Okay.
And it's also in the motion picture. There's a scene where you see this planetoid.
When they're doing the colonar, yeah, which is kind of weird. Yeah.
And they fixed it. In the director's cut, they removed that from the sky.
Oh.
So, but it's in the original release. So it's sort of canon.
Yeah, I remember it.
Because it was in the motion picture in the sky. Yeah. So, but then they changed it in the director's cut. So is it not canon again? But
yeah.
Now it's for sure canon because it's been on this episode, unless we get some weird director's cut. For sure, now it is canon that Vulcan, while it does not have a moon, has a very bizarre co-orbiting planetoid called T'Kut, or the Watcher, which just, I guess, hangs out around Vulcan, and they're really close together, but only sometimes you can see them. I don't really know the deal with T'Kut. I thought it was a little bizarre, but it's definitely
that
something
weird.
Notable for canonistas out there.
Huh. Interesting. I also have to point out in the 2009 movie, it bugs me when Spock from a different planet is able to see the destruction of Vulcan, right? Like in the sky.
It is as large as, it's like bigger than the moon would be in the sky. Yeah.
Yeah. The only way you could do that is if it were like two planetoids locked in like orbit around each other.
Maybe he was on T'Kut.
No, they establish he's on like... I can't remember what it is. But
maybe there are two co-orbiting planetoids.
Ah, okay. Never mind. I take it back.
You just keep adding planetoids until it makes sense.
Okay, we'll do that. Now, we need to talk about, as we're phasing out, we need to talk about next week's episode. I'll say I avoid watching trailers for these. I have not seen a single... Apart from stuff for the pilot, I haven't seen any of the trailers because I prefer to go into these episodes a blank slate. Mm-hmm. Do you are you the same opinion, or do you watch these trailers and dissect them?
So I am. I am very vehemently anti next week.
Yeah.
On the show, trailer things. I hate when shows do it. I never watch them. I watched most of this week's because it came on and I was drawn to it and I thought, oh, it's Star Trek. I should, I'm writing for the site and we're going to be talking in the Slack and we're going to be writing articles about it, so I should know what's going on, and I wish I hadn't seen it.
Okay, all right, well, I won't watch it.
So I'll probably go back to my usual not watching them.
Yeah, I mean, I would always watch the next week on Star Trek, The Next Generation. And
Star Trek.
They ruin most of the episodes most of the time with those.
Yeah. Yep. And to be fair, I think they've gotten better in modern things.
Yeah.
They're a lot more vague. Back in the day, though, if you went to the movies and you watched the trailers at the front of the movies, trailers from the 80s and 90s would tell the entire plot.
Entire, yeah. And the one I think I cited a little while ago was the A Time to Kill, the Samuel L. Jackson, where they like show his climactic, you know, line of the "Yes, I deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell." Like in the
trailer.
In the trailer, and it's like, ugh, you just showed me everything.
Well, this one wasn't so bad. I'm sure there's a lot that wasn't revealed, but I'm like you. I like to be pure,
fresh, yeah,
going in. So, oh well. But I have to say, we are going for another record of the longest Star Trek episode name.
Yeah,
we still haven't beat it. But the episode title is "Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad." Episode number 7.
Was that from anything?
I don't know. It sounds very Shakespearean, but it's probably not.
It's not. I don't think so.
Oh, it's Homer. It's Homer.
Oh, okay. There you go. All right. I keep hoping and praying for some sort of Harry Potter reference with Lorca, and so maybe we'll get it next week.
The Horcrux.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he's got the Elder Wand in his trophy room.
Oh, that'd be so cool. Something random in the trophy room. Oh, well. But since I just Googled this, I think I will round out this episode with the Homer quote, the Homeric quote. "There is the heat of love, the pulsing rush of longing, the lover's whisper, irresistible, magic to make the sanest man go mad."
Mm.
Next week on Shuttlepod at the Disco, we talk episode 7, "Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad," which will be released on October 29th in the U.S. and Canada. What might happen in episode 7? I don't know, but I think it's going to have a lot to do with creepy Stamets.
Yeah, and it also might be kind of Halloween themed, because it'll come out the week of Halloween.
Ooh, well, certainly if Brian Fuller were around, I feel like it would have to be.
It would have to be, because I hear he likes Halloween.
He does.
Yeah. Also, you know, the idea of doing a Homer quote continues the Greek mythology thread.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to be, upon reflection of this season, probably seeing a lot of that thread dragged through everything, which is pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, that is cool. It shows that kind of intratextuality shows a lot of forethought and planning.
All right, so until next week, we will see which sane man goes mad on Star Trek Discovery and which sane Shuttlepod crew member goes mad next week.
I'm pretty sure it's Stamets, right? Because he's the one who had some magic and seems to be going crazy.
Some magic mushrooms, and he's a little too much magic mushrooms.
Did.
All right, thanks, guys. This about does it for Shuttlepod at the Disco, episode number 5. See you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel for episode number 6.
Take care, everybody.
Bye.